Hey, you guys, welcome back to Flickers of Fear. So, in terms of horror movies in general, I feel like the 1980s, yes, there was a lot of different genres going on, but I feel like the 1980s was kind of like the decade of the slasher, right? I mean, they were very easy to make for a low budget, kind of like, you know, found footage or zombie ones would be later on. At the time, there was a huge booming video market and the movies could go direct to video. And, you know, back then there wasn't a lot to do, like, other than go rent movies. So they had this built-in audience of horror fans who would rent pretty much anything that had like a cool premise, a cool cover, and had maybe some creative or grisly kills in it, or nudity, boobies, whatever. Like, you know, so you had like a ready-made audience there already for you. By the time the latter part of the 80s rolled around, though, I feel like slashers were kind of like on a little bit of a decline, at least in the US. I guess that there were some European filmmakers that were still kind of cranking them out for the American video market. So one of these movies, which not exactly lost in the sense of being like completely forgotten about, but it did go direct to VHS back in 1988. And sort of then, after that, like, slipped under the radar a little bit. But it has been, I guess, rediscovered, if you want to use that term. And it has been given a recent, really nice restoration and Blu-ray release from, I believe, Arrow Video, who always do amazing work. And the movie that we are referring to is actually the Spanish-American co-production known as Edge of the Axe. Now, this is a very oddball kind of slasher. It was directed by Jose Ramon Larraz, using the pseudonym Joseph Bronstein for this. He's probably best known to horror fans today for directing the 1974, like, erotic horror film Vampires, with the Y, and the 1987 slasher film, like, Rest in Pieces, both of which I have seen at various times. His last horror film, which I haven't seen, was released in 1990. It was also a slasher film, and it was titled Deadly Manor. Now, I will admit that I had never actually heard of Edge of the Axe until Shudder added it to their lineup a while back. I don't know if it's on Shudder anymore, at least in the US, but it is on Tubi and various other streaming services, so you can absolutely, like, watch it for free. So I was actually kind of intrigued to check it out. I mean, slashers aren't my favorite subgenre of horror. That would probably be, like, haunted house movies or maybe, like, giallo. I guess slashers are kind of, like, modified giallo movies. But because it was kind of being touted as this underseen gem, I figured that I should probably, like, give it a watch at some point because it just kept turning up on, like, all these streaming services. Just, I guess, because Arrow did, like, a big, pretty, like, re-release of it. So while I will say that, in my personal opinion, I don't think that Edge of the Axe is a particularly notable example of, you know, the slasher form, maybe. But it does have enough weird quirks to it to absolutely make it worth watching. It's not especially gory, and there's no sex and no nudity, so don't go into it, like, thinking that you're gonna get that. But the killer has kind of, like, a creepy look. It is a little bit Michael Myers-y, but it has its own thing going on. And some of the axe kills and other special effects are actually really decent. And I'm sure that they probably just used, like, a rubber axe or whatever for this, but one thing that I will give this credit for is that I kind of feel like in a lot of other axe murder slasher type movies, like, they kind of swing the axe and they cut away and then you just kind of see the aftermath, whereas this one actually does look like somebody's actually hitting somebody repeatedly, like, with an axe, and it kind of really does look like it's going into them. So, you know, and I like the way that they kind of, like, pulled that off. It just seems a lot more, even though it's not all that gory, it seems a lot more violent, or it seems a lot more visceral, just because it looks kind of, like, more realistic. Now, the characters in this are, I'm gonna say, largely unlikable, and some of them are downright obnoxious. And there are kind of too many red herrings and, like, subplots and stuff like that that don't really factor into the overall story. But, I mean, that aspect gave me a little bit of a giallo vibe, because some, you know, some kind of lesser giallo movies have that as well, so I didn't really mind it all that much. On the other hand, though, I will say that keeping track of all the characters and, like, their relationships to one another was kind of confusing, like, even for me, and I'm a writer, so I usually try to keep track of all that stuff, and I was just like, wait, who is this now, and how are you related to, who is this? I don't know what the fuck's going on. So, and I will say, too, that I was able to guess the big twist ending without too much trouble. Your mileage may vary on that, because I have seen like some other reviews, they said, oh, they didn't see it coming. I actually guessed it, but I don't know if that's necessarily because, oh, I'm so big and smart and everything, but it's just I've seen like some other movies like this, and so I was kind of like, oh, I see what you're doing there. Yeah, so I guessed it. Because, and there were like a lot of deliberate obfuscation and false leads and stuff like that, but I knew what they were doing, and so I was able to kind of like cut through all the stuff and be like, yeah, I see what I know what you're gonna do. I know what you're gonna do, and yeah, I was right. So the story of Edge of the Axe, it takes place in this kind of small mountain town called Paddock, I think it's called Paddock, and it's near Big Bear Lake in California. Now, as far as I could determine, most or all of the exteriors in this were actually shot on location in Big Bear Lake, California. I think most of the interiors and some of the other kind of like smaller pickup shots and stuff like that were actually shot in Madrid, Spain, like I said, because this is a Spanish co-production. Now, at the very beginning of the movie, we see this woman sitting in her car smoking, and the car is going through the car wash. And she gets, not all that graphically, axed to death by a dude in a white mask who very determinedly, like, walks straight through all the swirling car wash machinery bullshit to kind of dispatch his victim. So, you know, you gotta give him points for determination, I guess. So there's a close-up of, like, a red medical cross sticker, like, on the woman's car window, like the driver's side window, which will actually factor into the plot. It will make some sense later on. So anyway, now that we know that there's an axe murder on the loose, as if the title of the movie didn't clue you in already, we kind of get eased into the main story. So our lead character, sort of, I guess, is this young guy named Gerald, played by an actor named Barton Falks, who I think was not, I think he maybe he teaches acting nowadays, but he was only like in a couple of movies. So this character, Gerald, he arrived in Paddock a short time before for some unclear reason. I don't really think they ever give any reason. I don't know if he's just like, I don't know, he's just like wandering around from place to place. So he's been staying in this cabin on the property of this cranky old coot named Brock, I think is his name. Now, Brock is always giving Gerald shit because all of Gerald's computer equipment, because he's like a computer nerd, kind of, and, you know, a pretty big deal for 1988, I guess, is kind of apparently causing the cabin's, like, electric bill to just go through the roof, and Brock is not having it. Now, at first, like, when I was first introduced to these characters, I thought Brock was, like, Gerald's grandpa or his uncle or something, because of the way they spoke to one another. It just seemed, like, familial, or, like, you know, it just kind of seemed like that. But I guess not. I mean, I guess that Brock is just a random old man that Gerald rents a cabin from, I think. I'm not entirely sure. I thought they were related, because the way they kind of, like, fuck with each other seems like, I don't know, like I said, it seemed, like, kind of familial. And then at one point, Gerald says, I love you, old man, and I'm just like, okay, I don't know, I just thought it was weird. I thought it was his grandpa or his uncle, but I guess it's not, and it doesn't really matter, like, anyway, but I'm just saying. So, Gerald's best friend is this kind of budget Tom Cruise-looking douchebag named Richard Simmons. Yes, that's really his name. And he's actually played by Paige Mosley, who I thought looked kind of familiar. He's apparently, like, best known for being on that 80s soap opera Santa Barbara, which I don't think I ever watched that, so I don't know if I would have recognized him for that. Maybe my grandma watched it or something like that, but I don't know. He looked, like, kind of familiar. He does look kind of Tom Cruise-y, though. Like, he has that kind of, like, cocky young Tom Cruise kind of vibe going. So Richard is an exterminator and is also married to an older woman named Laura, who's actually played by a Spanish actress named Patty Shepard. And basically, like, Richard is basically constantly bagging on his wife. I mean, he low-key threatens at one point to, quote-unquote, fumigate her. And he openly admits to marrying her only because she's rich. So there's that. About 5 minutes into the movie, I think it's like literally 5-7 minutes into the movie, Richard is already like enthusiastically trying to kick off an affair with this younger woman who works at a tavern or something, or a restaurant or something. And I will also note too that Gerald, the supposed good guy hero of the movie, is being his wingman in this, even though he's pretty, I'm pretty sure that he knows that Richard is married because they talk about his wife all the time. So he's just like, yeah, go get him, Tiger. You know, that kind of thing. So I was like, okay, that's a little weird, whatever. So it turns out that Richard has been called out to this tavern to investigate this terrible smell that's coming from somewhere, I think in the basement. So he brings Gerald along for some reason. I mean, he says, oh, come along with me because I need your nose, or he says something like that. But as we will soon see, like, the odor that they're investigating is apparently so overpowering that I'm not really sure why you'd need like another person, like to sort of triangulate where it was coming from. I don't know. It was just like a whole weird situation. So unsurprisingly, you know, because this is a slasher movie, the stink is coming from the dead body of a former employee named Maria, who has been stuffed up into the crawl space. Like there's kind of like a, you know, a trapdoor type thing in the ceiling, and somebody stuffed her up there. Incidentally, I will say that I think the corpse effect here was probably my favorite of the whole movie. Like when they pull the thing down, like her body comes down, I think like that corpse effect looks really good. And I think that was probably my favorite effect in the movie. So even though it's pretty clear that this woman was most likely murdered, I mean, she didn't stuff herself up into a crawl space, the local sheriff calls it a suicide and basically wants to just kind of sweep everything under the rug. He doesn't want to like investigate any crimes. What the fuck you think? This is a job or something like that? This is the same sheriff, by the way, who, and I can't remember if this happens before or after this situation, but he very assholishly like dismisses this farmer who comes into his office to report that somebody has been on his farm, has beheaded one of his pigs, broken into his house, and then left the decapitated pig's head, like, in the middle of his bed. And the sheriff literally, he comes in and reports this. He's like, it scared my wife to death. It was somebody creeping around outside my farm or whatever. And the sheriff literally tells him, and this is a direct quote, call someone who gives a shit. And I was just kind of like, really? Wow. I was like, actually, you're paid to give a shit, and it doesn't really look like you're doing anything particularly important at the moment, so maybe you should kind of, you know, get off your ass and, like, do some shit. Yeah, so the sheriff in this, and I don't know if this was, like, deliberate, like, they were trying to be, like, funny or something like that, but the sheriff in this is a real fucking twat waffle. I mean, he just basically tries to write off, because as the murders like start to stack up, like as the movie goes on, and he just wants to write off every single one. It's like, well, first one's suicide, it was an accident, she got hit by a train or some shit like that. So I guess so he doesn't have to like investigate anything or like move an inch from his desk chairs, like, oh, we don't want to panic everybody in the village, I don't want to have to do any work, fuck this shit. So it's that kind of thing. I will say too that both him and his deputies or the other people working on the case are also like super insensitive, like about the victims, almost implying a couple times that it's like, ah, they had it coming, or, you know, saying, oh, she looked like hamburger, you know what I mean? And I'm just like, great, this is really the kind of people you want, like, investigating. So there's that whole thing. But I was, like I said, I don't know if that was supposed to be funny or if that was just, I don't know what it was. It was just very, very weird. So meanwhile, while all that nonsense is going on, Gerald has kind of like a meet cute with this nice young girl named Lillian, who's played by Christina Marie Lane. And she's apparently the daughter of a guy who owns another like bar restaurant type establishment in this little town. So Gerald tries to impress Lillian with his vast knowledge of video games, as well as late 1980s computer technology, while also throwing a little of a condescension into the mix there for, oh, I don't think you'd understand this, he says, after he tells her something that's really, really easy to understand. I'm just kind of like, okay, that's how you want to come at it, blah. So yeah. So apparently, though, that works. She's charmed by his nerdy but possibly dangerous drifter vibe, because, like I said, I'm not really sure, like, why he moved there. And I know, like, in light of what comes out later on, like, I know why they set it up like that, but yeah. So, yeah, so the two of them kind of start a little bit of a romance. So Gerald, who has just set up a brand new state-of-the-art, for 1988, computer system in his cabin, even offers to give Lillian his old one so that they can communicate with one another on what I guess is like a very instant, like a very early like iteration of maybe like instant messaging or something, or email or something like that. And it's weird because, I mean, I give this movie credit. It's one of the few slashers that I can think of, actually maybe the only one that I could think of, that incorporates what was then kind of advanced computer tech like into the actual plot. I guess you could say that Evil Speak did that too, although that was a more supernatural kind of thing. But the tech angle in this even features some kind of pre-internet shenanigans where Gerald's computer can answer questions that you ask it, like you type in questions, like by accessing a central terminal, like he calls it that. But it predictably, like, Lillian uses this cutting edge feature to ask the computer, which is named Icarus, if Gerald is gay. Not really sure, like, why, because she keeps going, well, turn around, I'm gonna ask it something, turn around, I want you to look. And then he's like, what did you ask it? It keeps saying like data incomplete. She's like, I asked if you were gay. This is like never brought up again. I was just like, all right, that's what I mean, like how it's very, very oddball. This movie is like very oddball. And another thing, like along those same lines, I'll note here too that some of the conversations that people have with one another, especially the interactions between these two, between Gerald and Lillian, are really weird. Like, not at all like anything real life humans would actually say to one another. Yeah, it was just giving me a real like oddball vibe. It's strange, but it is actually kind of entertaining, to be honest, because you don't ever really know like what bizarre turn of phrase is going to fall out of a character's mouth next. So, oh, and I will say too, like the music in this is really odd too. It's mostly like these kind of silly, like upbeat country songs. One of the songs that they play a couple times over the end credits, and then they play it at one point earlier in the movie too, that actually has lyrics relating directly to the murders, but the song is like real kind of like upbeat and cheerful, and it's just, it's so bizarre. It's just, it's kind of, I mean, this is just like a kooky kind of flick, you guys. So as the movie goes on, more people start falling prey to this roving axe murderer, including a beautician and part-time prostitute named Rita. That's one of the victims. Richard's older wife, Laura, who had actually recently learned she was bankrupt. So she got murdered not too long after that. So, you know, she didn't have to live as a poor person. So I'm sure that was a happy, that was a silver lining. Laura's bit on the side and possible early suspect named Christopher. He gets killed too. He's actually played by Jack Taylor, who I immediately recognized from, he was in Pieces from 1982. And he was also in The Ninth Gate. I think that's where I mostly recognized it from. The farmer's wife from the earlier pig head incident, she gets murdered too. And the leader of the church choir, I guess she's like the leader of the church. No, she doesn't play the organ. I guess she's like the choir director or something like that. It's a woman named Anna. Now, her dog also gets it, sadly. Although at least it happens off screen. You do see like the dead dog, but they don't like show it getting axed. So there's that. But yeah, the dog gets killed in this one too. Now, along the way, you know, while all these bodies are piling up, several people are also kind of fleetingly hinted to be the killer. Like I said, there's a lot of red herrings in this. So some of these include Christopher, who I mentioned before. I mean, he's literally maybe in one or two scenes before he gets killed. I don't even remember if he has any lines. The town priest, Father Clinton, it seems like they're trying to set him up as a suspect for like 5 seconds, like because he acts sort of vaguely sketchy in one scene, but then the rest of the time he's totally normal. And the jackwagon exterminator guy, Richard, who laughs about the axe murders and kind of cracks, oh, I should talk to this axe killer about getting rid of my wife. And I'm just like, yeah, well, the axe killer does kill his wife later on. So I think they're trying to like set him up for that too. But it's not like super effective, you know what I'm saying? Because they're just, there's so many characters. And like I said, I forget what all of them, and sometimes it's so brief or so subtle that I didn't even realize until afterward that they were trying, I was like, oh, they're trying to make that seem like that guy, maybe this guy's the killer, maybe that guy's the killer, you know what I mean? They're just like introducing like all of these characters just so they'd have more suspects, I guess. But I will say that the scenario that the movie is trying hardest to sell is that the killer is Lillian's cousin, Charlie. So Lillian explains to Gerald at one point that when Charlie was a kid, she was like pushing him on a swing and she pushed him too hard and he fell off and fractured his skull. So this injury apparently caused some brain damage and Charlie had to be institutionalized for a while. Now she says he's recently gotten out and Lillian has deduced that Charlie has come back to town and is like taking revenge against people who either had some involvement in putting him in the mental hospital in the first place or people who worked there. So I guess like once he got out, he's like, yeah, I'm gonna kill all those motherfuckers. And that's why when I said earlier, like the very first scene, like with the woman getting killed in the car wash and why they linger on this like little red cross sticker that she has, they're like, ooh, it's a nurse, you know what I mean? So it does kind of make sense later on. One thing that doesn't make sense, though, is that a bunch of the victims, like including the beautician slash prostitute, the lady that was the church choir director, stuff like that, no hint is really given that any of those people were medical personnel or had anything to do with the hospital. So there's that. But Lillian actually kind of sort of like waves this away by saying, oh, and by the way, Charlie is also killing women that his father has the hots for, I think. I think that's what she's getting at. So they had to have some kind of way, because it would be like be super suspicious if like, oh, all these nurses and doctors are turning up dead. Then everybody be like, oh, pattern. But the fact it's like all these random ass people, and it's like one of them was a nurse at the beginning, and then like the other ones weren't anything to do with that. So it's like I said, they were trying to make everything like mysterious, but they just, in a lot of ways, they just kind of made it, like, not coherent or, like, not make any sense. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying it's a bad movie. It's actually, like, really fun. I had a fun time with it. But it is, like, a little odd. And don't, like, get too wrapped up in the story because it doesn't make a lot of sense. That's all I'm saying. So along those same lines, it's, like, it's further implied that Gerald, who just arrived in town not too long before with no explanation, as I said, so you're supposed to be believing that Gerald is actually Charlie and that he's the one that's the axe murderer. And they really lean into this a lot because Lillian actually even accidentally calls him Charlie at one point. I think she's even like he's even on a swing or some shit like that. And then later she comments on the scar on the back of his neck, which, you know, he says, oh, it's from a motorcycle accident, like all sketchy and everything. And so people that are watching the movie are supposed to think, oh, that was the scar that was caused by falling off the swing. And so he's really Charlie and he's the axe murderer. But I will say that because I've seen a lot of giallo movies and slasher murder mysteries of this type, I was aware right from the jump that the narrative that they were pushing so hard, that's never the solution to the mystery. It's always a misdirect. And indeed, it was in this case. And when I found out what the twist was, I was absolutely vindicated because I called it. Now, as I surmised, and this is spoiler alert, spoiler alert, spoiler alert, if you do not want to know what the twist is, then click off and go watch this movie and then come back because I'm about to tell you. So, just as I predicted, the killer actually turns out to be Lillian, who did, actually, she was the one that fell off a swing and got brain damage as a kid, and then she got institutionalized and basically had some murderous, revengey sort of impulses and spun those off into another personality named Charlie. So she essentially, like, dissociated her murderous impulses into another person, and now that narrative has become, like, ingrained, so she actually does think of Charlie as, like, another person and that it's not her. Now, I did actually like this twist, even though it was still fairly obvious, but I will comment that whenever the axe murderer is shown during the kill scenes, it's very, very clearly a man. I mean, like, it's a big man. Like, this is, I mean, the woman that's playing Lillian is, like, a small, like, 20, 22-year-old woman, you know, and she's, in, like I said, she's quite petite. It's obviously not the same person. So I'm actually not sure, and maybe, I don't know, I'm actually not sure if the movie was trying to imply that Gerald was actually the killer all along, but that he was trying to gaslight Lillian into thinking she was Charlie. Like, that's a possibility too. But the scene at the very, very end where Gerald actually gets shot by the police, and then I think, like, the useless, you know, butthole sheriff hugs Lillian and says, oh, it's the nightmare's over, there won't be any more murders. But then she kind of, like, looks up and, like, smiles maniacally, like, at the camera, and then they freeze frame and then the credits run. That would seem to imply otherwise. That would seem to imply that she was the killer the whole time and that she almost had kind of, like, a split personality deal. But the fact that they clearly showed the axe murderer a few times and it was a man, like, I'm not really sure, like, what they were getting at with that. But I don't know. Maybe it's that I'm putting way more thought into this than anyone else did, which, you know, that is obviously just like me because that's something I would do. So I've thought about this, like, way more than is healthy, clearly. But yeah, it's, I mean, if you guys have any ideas, let me know. So, I mean, all in all, this is actually a pretty enjoyable slasher, if you like slashers. It has this quirky, almost like off-putting vibe, but it makes it kind of like interesting to watch. It's nothing to really write home about as far as like there's nothing that's all that like earth-shattering in it, but the axe kills are pretty decently handled. Like I said, they're not gory, but they're kind of like violent in the sense that you actually get to see the axe like going into people like that, like from a, you know, they don't cut away or have insert shots or anything like that. You know, and the special effects, particularly that corpse shot at the near the beginning, are actually pretty good for this era. The characters, gonna say, are almost all unappealing jerks, except for Lillian, who's lovely. And there's kind of way too much time spent on meaningless subplots and characters that are only like crammed in there to have more red herrings and like make the mystery more mysterious or whatever. But, you know, I guess that's kind of par for the course for kind of a low budget murder mystery, which is essentially what this is. So I can't really judge too harshly for that. So if you like slashers and you want to see one that's kind of like more of the same, like it has a lot of the slasher tropes, but also has some like weird eccentricity to it, then it's definitely worth checking out. I wouldn't go so far as to call it a lost classic, but if you like slashers, you should probably get around to seeing it. The Arrow release, if that's the one that's on Tubi, I think right now it actually looks really nice, like the restoration is lovely. And I think that the Blu-ray also has like a shit ton of extras on it, so if you're into that, then that's definitely something that you might want to pick up. But yeah, so that'll do it for this Flickers of Fear, and I will see you guys again on the next one. Bye.